From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul Deckett. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know a sequel episode to an episode that I think we all enjoyed much earlier when we did it for the first time. How long ago was that?
I was going to ask the same thing. A couple years?
It seems like it was a while back.
It's been forever.
Yeah, it was our episode on real life superpowers. Now, as we live in the age of superhero movies, the comic book movie renaissance, you could call it, we know that more and more people are familiar with the concept of the extraordinary abilities that we call superpowers. And there are a few that, even if you hate Marvel and DC movies and comic books in general, there are a few of these abilities that are totally familiar to everyone, like flying without the need of a plane, a helicopter, a glider, or so on. Right? That's one of the oldest ones, right?
Absolutely.
Even in ancient myths, gods can fly.
You know, I've never thought about this until now, but since most of the superheroes that fly don't have any kind of wing structure support, I conjecture that it is a psychic-based ability. It is almost like a telekinetic ability
Many
to control themselves, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely right, because I went through a phase a while back when I would ask people what three superpowers they could have. And I think we've all had this conversation off air.
I think we did in the last superpowers episode probably.
We probably did, yeah. And that's – flying is one that people don't think through all the way, because flying sounds cool unless it's a physical thing like swimming. Because if you can – just because you can swim doesn't mean you can swim across town. It would have to be something that doesn't exert muscle energy.
That's true, but I think that telekinesis now would fold a lot of things into itself, right?
Right.
Telekinesis, you could make yourself fly, and then you'd have that one checked off the list, and you could also, you know, throw knives at people in the air.
Yeah, I disagree on both counts, guys. All you have to do is master the Matrix, and once you've got that down, you can do anything.
Well, that's just bending the code, right?
Did you take the red pill or the blue pill?
Red pill, dude.
You know, that's like a weird, like, neo-Nazi thing, getting red-pilled.
I think it's misogyny.
It stands for a lot of things now.
Yeah, but specifically I heard that it was sort of like a way the alt-right are able to explain the way they started believing that Jewish people control the universe.
It also stands for the incel stuff, the involuntarily celibate movement.
Well, I take the red pill for other reasons, all you groups out there, and
that's fair.
Has to do with the Matrix.
The original reason. Yeah, talk about being misused. I bet the writers of the Matrix are pissed about that one. Another skill that people are familiar with would be the idea of extraordinary strength. As we explained in the last episode on real life superpowers, these strength powers come in two real life variations. The first is hysterical strength, which is a real thing. A parent sees their child run over by a car with a heavy weight on them, and they are able to, in a way that does damage them, they are able to temporarily lift much more weight than they could normally. The second and perhaps more disturbing one is a genetic mutation that's been found in, to date, one cow and one boy in Europe. And it's a mutation that removes the limits on their ability to build muscle mass. And these are just a few of the powers we covered in our previous episode. Each case in that episode and in this one, each of these cases have been scientifically verified. And while no one can fly unaided yet, our species is capable of some pretty amazing things. And so many, in fact, that we decided to do this long-awaited sequel because we found powers that didn't make it into the first episode. If you have not checked out Real Life Superpowers Part 1, please go ahead and do so now, because you will want the context to this. And honestly, you won't want to miss the first powers we discovered in that one because these other powers are a little different. So go ahead and pause this now. Give that one a listen and come back. We'll wait.
Okay, are you done listening to the Avengers episode? Cool. Good.
The Avengers?
Yeah, that's that last episode is basically the Avengers.
Right. We've got super sight, super strength.
Temperature regulation.
Yeah.
That's always my favorite.
Massive endurance. So those are the Avenger-level powers. This one is maybe for fans of comic books out there, and please write to us and let me know if you get this reference. This is more the Great Lakes Avengers episode.
Yeah, it's a deep cut.
You can also Google Great Lakes Avengers if you want to chuckle.
I can kind of put it together in my head. Mm-hmm. Is it sort of just like the workaday Joe Avengers kind of like doing their stuff out in the snow?
No. This is a superhero team.
It's their job.
But they're out in the Great Lakes, so I picture them being like good old salt of the earth types, you know?
Perhaps they're
loggers. I don't know.
I like where your head's at, but you gotta check those. I think you will enjoy reading about the Great Lakes Avengers.
I look forward to it.
Not too many spoilers, but definitely search the thing that Ben told me to search, which is Doorman. One word, Doorman.
Yeah.
Is he literally a doorman, like in a hotel?
Well, I don't want to spoil it for the listeners, so I'm not going to say it on air. But I think everybody who writes in will enjoy the Google search.
How have I not heard of this? Is this like a parody?
No, it's a real thing.
This is amazing.
But again, I'm not going to spoil it.
I'm looking at it right now, and it's, please, folks, well, check this out.
Yeah, let's see if it's a correct comparison. So here are the facts. Most of those extraordinary abilities that we discussed today fall into a few distinct categories.
Yeah, first you got the kind of what we spoke about before, some kind of genetic mutation that allows the human body, for one reason or another, from some small change at the genetic level, to allow just a tiny, a minuscule amount of human beings on the planet to do something greater than we usually could. We're talking about what? People who can see colors that most people can't see.
Tetrachromats.
Exactly.
Remember that one? Kind of the opposite of being color deficient or colorblind. They're all women due to the way the genetic expression works, and they can see way more colors than we will ever get to see.
Yeah. We just can't even fathom them. Even if you're looking at one of those massive color wheels, it's not on there.
Mm-hmm. They can also determine imperfections in colors that we would otherwise think are the same. So if anything, it's kind of an irritating superpower. Can you imagine being a tetrachromat and trying to paint your house?
Ooh, yeah, that'd be crazy.
And so second, and this is good news for a lot of us listening here, second, there are learned superpowers, such as people with blindness who have learned to practice echolocation. We all know what echolocation is, right? It's like how a lot of bats get around.
Or dolphins.
Dolphins, more particularly, right? I think dolphin would be the more correct use of it, wouldn't it?
No, bats are right up in there.
And so are a couple of people who have gone full-on daredevil, right?
Yeah, man.
And then there are people, like you mentioned in the beginning, Matt, people who have learned to control otherwise involuntary bodily functions through meditation.
That's pretty awesome. It's kind of like The Matrix.
It is. And there's one, there's a thing that I thought would interest you particularly, Noel. There's a fascinating audio file that we will get to later in today's show. It's weird.
I can't wait.
I don't even know if it's useful, but I think it's cool. I think we'll all like it.
Not file, as in an audio file, at file.
Right. Yes. He can make audio files with his head, which would actually be incredibly useful for us.
He's got like a little USB drive right on his temple, and he just pops in a stick and then hands it to you.
48K waves.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Nerd.
But third, there are people who have already acquired certain extraordinary abilities through kind of the Iron Man, Batman route. They've used technology, or what's known as wetware, biohacking, to give themselves a couple of extra things that you would not ordinarily have as a member of this species. And this is interesting, this third one, because this technology and biohacking, coupled with genetic research, forms the basis of current superpower research. And without spoiling things just yet, we're going to end by looking at the future in this episode. So stay tuned, because we want to hear what you think about some of the strange and, I think earlier we described as potentially huge, but I'll say what it is, potentially catastrophic changes.
Yeah.
They're just a couple of decades out from now. So enough preface, right? Let's get to the powers. That's why we're all here. We'll briefly describe them, and we'll follow up with some speculation on their usefulness.
Yeah, some of them are more usable than others. So what's first, Ben?
Here's where it gets crazy.
Oh, that should always be first.
Well, it's a little – I think it's weird because it's a little early in the episode, right? So super throws, super throwing. We've all thrown stuff.
Yeah.
Most of us.
You can huck a, I don't know, a cantaloupe fairly far, which is difficult to do because my hand isn't big enough to palm a cantaloupe. But it's fun to attempt to throw one really far after it's gone bad.
You've got above average sized hands, I would say, Matt.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Yeah, no problem, man.
Can I be your lawyer?
Yes. Yes, you may. Okay, cool. I need
that's worth it. That's worth it. God, that character is so creepy, but I love him.
I know.
So
who are we talking about?
We're talking about Charlie's uncle in Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, yes.
He's okay. Very worried about the size of his hands and what qualifies as art. Oh, boy. So this super throwing may be a thing. Some people will tell you it is, and it all goes back to polydactyly, which is the fancy word for being born with extra digits or one extra digit on your hand or on your feet.
Fingers and or toes.
Fingers and toes, yeah. Not like a little baby hand growing out of your regular hand. So it's the second most common congenital hand disorder. And what we're talking about specifically is something called radial polydactyly. So for everyone who's seen our new logo.
Wait, what? You're going to tell people? Do it.
No, we shouldn't.
Spoil the beans.
No, it's too late. We've said too much.
Spoil the beans?
Spoil the beans.
Spoil the beans. I like it. So this radial polydactyly stuff, one in every 3,000 live births. And when this occurs, you'll see something where it looks like someone has an extra pinky, maybe, or even more extra digits. And
so it goes off that side of the hand, not on the side of the thumb, off the
– it can go
either way.
Okay. But the thing that's crazy about it is that many, many more people have been born with this condition than you might imagine. Often people, when they're born with extra tiny fingers or something, there's no way for the doctors to tell whether those are going to be functional later in life or just awkward looking.
So you kind of have to just wait?
So, well, often they get cut off at birth.
Oh.
So it's quite possible that, you know, some of us listening may have been born with that condition and the doctor just snipped off that extra thumb.
Jeez.
Because they didn't know if it was going to be just hanging around.
It wouldn't leave a mark, though? Some kind of telltale sign?
Right. Good question. Like, would it leave a line of a scar right here along the base of your hand under your pinky? The thing is, that cut would have occurred so early that the scar would become imperceptible.
You
eventually.
Know, it's kind of cool. There's a lot of stuff in folklore and in various cultures from around the world about how extra digits and toes are actually a sign of some kind of provenance, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Like you know, there are read places saying that Adam, you know, of Adam and Eve fame, possibly had six fingers. And in the Chaco Canyon area of New Mexico, the ancient Pueblo culture have all kinds of cave paintings of six fingers and six toed sandals and things like that. And it's this polydactyly has been considered to be revered as some kind of great prophet or some kind of great warrior or some kind of imbued with some kind of power.
Yeah, it's considered auspicious. The highest rate of occurrence is in the Indian subcontinent. But if you think about it, one out of 3,000 people is pretty common as far as these sorts of conditions go. And this means that most cultures through antiquity would have been familiar with it. In some cultures, it was seen as a sign of the devil or demonic origin. But in other cultures, it was seen as a very, very auspicious thing. In the case of Antonio Alfonseca, it was a weird piece of trivia that always got included with descriptions of his career as a baseball pitcher. You see, Antonio was born with six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot. He had a great sinker, the type of pitch he was known for. His teammates called him El Pulpo, or
the Pulpo?
The octopus, yes. And he was called this because of his six fingers on each hand. And yes, we know that's not technically correct. That's 12 digits. But he did not have these removed at birth, unlike a lot of other people. And so when he was pitching, people began to credit his pitching ability to some sort of perceived better grip on the ball.
Interesting. And, it would certainly be different than the standard.
Sure, sure. But then also we could say the same thing about someone who, for instance, had fused fingers and only had three fingers, right? Mm-hmm. They would have a different grip as well. But the problem is that his extra digit was, if you look at it, it's kind of an extra pinky. And it didn't seem to, at least from what he said, it didn't seem to come into contact with the ball when he was actually holding it. So usefulness, I don't know. We'll have to wait for a polydactyl person to maybe take up piano or some other instrument like maybe a sitar or a harp, something with a lot of strings. And additionally, for it to be a benefit to them, they'd need extra digits to work independently like their other fingers. And that's not as common as just straight up polydactyl cases. So there you go.
There you go. A little bit more on Alfonseca. He played for the Braves for, I think, one or two seasons. I definitely remember seeing his name floating around in the Braves roster for a while. It was 2004. Okay, so it was a single season, 2004. But you probably remember him if it is ringing your head from his years with the Florida Marlins.
That's right.
Look, I have a very limited baseball memory, but I actually do. I looked up his name and I saw his face. And I was like, oh, yeah, I do remember this guy.
El Pulpo.
Yeah, El Pulpo. I don't remember that part. But that's really interesting. I don't remember him being amazing, though.
No. He was just a competent pitcher.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's not as if he were like the LeBron James of pitching or something.
Yeah. You know?
But it was just, I think it was a good story for slow news days often.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there any more impressive examples of super throwing?
Of super throwing, no. But there are examples of things that you could call super catching a little later down the line.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So we've shown one we're kind of debunking that one. It's possible, for instance, that we're all familiar with the film Gattaca. It's possible that there could be in the future a polydactyl person who's just an amazing piano player.
Oh, though, right? I could imagine that.
There's that one scene in Gattaca where you see that they've grown people to have extra fingers.
I mean, surely they don't have the same amount of dexterity in their extra digits as they do in their – I mean, you know what I mean?
Not in most cases.
In most cases.
Yeah, that's what I was just saying. Yeah, not in most cases. Most cases, it's kind of just hanging there. Mm-hmm. It's not a digit that could move independently. And even for most people, if you've ever tried it, most people cannot raise their ring finger by itself. Have you ever tried to do that?
I cannot do that.
It's a learned skill. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to just practice those muscles, and this is the best I can give you. It's like,
whoa, that's really good, Matt.
No, it's not good, actually. It's not good at all.
Oh, that's so weird.
It's terrible.
I freaked out too. Yeah, let us know if you could do that. Send proof. Because I don't want to be too cynical, but
it won't let me. My hands physically won't.
I don't know anyone who can do it, Here's something that's a little bit more useful, but it takes us to a really dark time in human history. The Black Plague, right?
Fun!
Yeah, one of the greatest hits in the stories of pandemics, So waves of disease. The Black Plague is an umbrella term for several distinct waves of disease that completely, Paul, you might have to edit me here, that completely fuck up Europe in ways that still echo today. That's one of the disasters that, when portrayed in film, is actually not exaggerated, is maybe softened a little bit because they have to have their main characters in the fictional story live to the end of the story or live through part of it, and most people didn't. It was terrible. It was so bad. It fundamentally changed the course of human history, and it also provided a certain segment of the population with a superpower. It turns out that evolutionary pressures applied to the Black Plague may have resulted in immunity to HIV for about 10% of the current European descended population, which counts you guys as well. So it's quite possible. I mean, don't go gambling on this one.
Yeah.
Don't bet on it because your odds are not great. But it's possible that we in the studio and you out there listening, we could be immune to HIV. Not HIV resistant, not less likely to get it, straight up immune to the disease.
Wait, is there a connection between the plague and HIV?
I'm glad you asked. Yeah, it's a mystery, but there's some pretty good science behind it. So the individuals who currently now carry this genetic immunity to HIV have a mutation known as CCR5-A32, and this prevents the HIV virus from entering the cells of the immune system.
And that's Creedence Clearwater Revival 5.
Right, right. America 32. Yeah. And this immunity made national news in 2007, which I think – let's see, Matt – this was like right before we started working together.
Correct.
And I remember we talked about this years ago. There was an individual who was having a terrible, terrible time in life. This person was infected with HIV, and additionally, they had leukemia. Luckily, they were in a place that had a European approach to modern medicine. So they didn't die due to a bank account problem. They received a bone marrow transfusion, and this not only treated his leukemia, it also, to everyone's surprise, cured him of HIV.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And he went – they didn't believe it for the first couple of years. 5 years later, he still doesn't have HIV. They don't really know what's going on until they figured out it appears that the bone marrow donor carried that immunity, that mutation, and successfully transferred this to the leukemia patient. In following years, other patients in similar situations exhibited the same results. And to your question, Noel, for a long time, scientists couldn't understand how this could work at all, because not only did the mutation develop way before the rise of HIV, but if the Black Plague was bubonic plague, if it was bacterial in nature, it wouldn't make much sense because HIV is a virus. It's viral in nature. So two professors who worked on this, Christopher Duncan and Susan Scott, wrote a book called Return of the Black Death, which is a great book. I'd also recommend, if you're interested in light reading, Norman Cantor's In the Wake of the Plague. These professors said that the concepts of the Black Death were incorrect, and that the plague sweeping through Europe from 1347 to 1660 were in fact a continuing series of epidemics of a lethal viral hemorrhagic fever that used this CCR5 that we're talking about as an entry port into the immune system. So it's kind of like this mutation shuts the door for both this virus and HIV to get in. And around the time that the plague hit, according to their mathematical models, the mutation occurred in about 1 out of 20,000 people, and pressure from the plague alone brought this number up to something more like 1 in 10 or 10%. So again, that's amazing. That is an incredibly powerful thing.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And earned through the death of millions.
Now we just have to figure out how to transfer that into everybody.
Right. Right, exactly. And there have been some promising breakthroughs in HIV research just this year as we record this. Of course, the origins of HIV remain a contested topic, which I think we did an episode on.
Here's another awesome thing. Let's say you're traveling somewhere in the world where you may have to worry about contracting malaria. There are several places in the world where this is a real danger. Here is a very strange thing, and maybe it's just something that has come through evolution to the human body because of the way another thing functions within the human body, and that's sickle cell anemia. Mm-hmm. If you happen to have that, it appears to or seems to, in many cases, you probably have some form of inborn resistance to malaria. pretty sweet, right? Mm-hmm. That's a cool thing. Having sickle cell anemia, not good at all, because this is a very dangerous medical condition, and there are a lot of side effects from having it, and it's not fun whatsoever. However, it's some weird little trade-off of having a weakness. Mm-hmm. You also have this superpower, or maybe it's both, I guess.
Yeah, and we can go into the science of it maybe in a different episode. It just, without going too far in the weeds, the way it works is that the effect that sickle cell anemia has on your red blood cells is that it makes them abnormally shaped, and it doesn't provide protection against infection by the malaria parasite. Instead, it prevents the disease from taking hold after the organism, or in this case, the person, has been infected. So it's still a bad condition,
yeah.
But in the right circumstances, at least according to evolution, it's better to have sickle cell anemia than malaria.
There you go.
So that's strange. I would say the HIV immunity is a little bit less dangerous to have, since there's not such a trade-off. Or I guess the trade-off was surviving again. I'm trying to think of a word stronger than horrific. Like one of the worst things that happened in history.
Yeah.
The plagues. But that's a useful one. We're trying to vary between the useful and the unuseful. I found one that I thought I wanted to hear you guys take on. You remember Seven? Did you guys like Seven?
The film?
The film. No, yeah. Just the number. Do you remember that number? It's a great one.
Yeah. Talking about Lucky Number 11?
Mm. What's that?
Oh, it's a movie with, yeah. What's his name? Die Hard. Bruce Willis is in it.
I haven't
seen
it.
He plays an assassin named Slevin.
Oh, boy.
And the movie's called Lucky Number 11.
Oh, geez.
In this one, I think we're talking about a serial murderer. He's a torturist, maybe? A torturer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't necessarily kill all the time, but he has someone else do the killing without spoiling too much of the movie Seven.
Or, well, it's past the statute of limitations, right?
It's Kevin Spacey, you guys.
Yeah. Who is not billed in the movie. Okay, let's go ahead. You want to do a spoiler countdown for everybody?
Three.
So, two.
It's Kevin Spacey, you guys.
Yeah, it's Kevin Spacey. He appears in the very last act of the film, uncredited, because he did not want to, quote, ruin the surprise. But one of the ways in this story, one of the ways that he gets away with all these horrific acts that are meant to echo the Ten Commandments or the violation thereof, is that
the seven deadly sins.
The seven deadly sins. Yes, thank you. That's the name of the movie. Yes, good save. He gets away with, or he's not apprehended for a while, because he has, through a very painful process, removed his own fingerprints. It turns out some people just don't have fingerprints genetically.
And just for the record, you guys, I wanted to throw that Kevin Spacey bit out there in case you watched the movie for the first time, not knowing that he was in it, and then you would have been super pissed by the end of it when he came out, and you're like, I didn't want to watch a Kevin Spacey movie. That guy sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So I saved you from that moment. So you're welcome.
But in this case, he plays the villain that you're rooting against.
Doesn't matter.
So in some way, maybe it's, I don't know.
And I don't think he's getting much money for that film. I think that's mainly Brad Pitt and the other guy. But yeah.
Morgan Freeman.
Isn't he also a bit of a Me Too guy? Didn't he do some bad stuff too?
Morgan Freeman?
Yeah. There was a Me Too moment for Morgan Freeman.
Well, I had not heard that. I'll look that up.
As Michael Che said at the Emmys just the other night, hello to all of you famous rich people in Hollywood who haven't been caught yet.
Yeah, true. Too true. So, lack of fingerprints. In 2007, there's a Swiss woman in her late 20s who ran into a really irritating Kafka-esque problem. She could prove who she was in every way that mattered, except for one. Customs agents at the U.S. border could not confirm her identity because, despite the fact that everything in her passport matched, including her photograph and all that slow jazz, when the agent scanned her hand, they found out she had no fingerprints. And it turns out, instead of being some master criminal or some insane sadist, She has an extremely rare genetic condition known as adermatoglyphia, lack of fingerprints. We're throwing out the fancy words today.
Adermatoglyphia. A-D-E-R-M-A-T-O-G-L-Y-P-H-I-A. Adermatoglyphia.
Yeah, there you go. That's a nice voice for that, Matt. So this condition mainly makes immigration and travel such a pain in the ass that one dermatologist researching it, a doctor named Peter Eiten, called it the immigration delay disease.
Nice.
So usefulness, it could have been useful in the days before GPS tracking and DNA testing. Like you could have been a master thief or of some sort maybe in the 40s through the 50s or 60s.
Definitely.
So the heyday of that fingerprintless crime mob has come and gone.
If you had that coupled, it's a terrible disease that a lot of people suffer with where you lose all of your hair.
Alopecia.
Alopecia in your entire body. If you had alopecia and, I've already lost it in the outline and there's no way I'm going to be able to say it again.
Adermatoglyphia.
Thank you. If you had both of those in the 1930s, 40s, really any time before the 1960s, yeah, you could have been a master thief.
Dare to dream. Dare to dream. So the next one's a weird one. It's super strange, and I think it warrants its own episode.
So, well, why don't we hear a quick word from our sponsor before we get into it?
Okay, imagine a world in which humans might be able to smell with the sophistication of a dog, run with the burst of a cheetah, stay underwater as long as a seal or a whale, or sleep with one half of each brain at a time. Or heck, how about just regrowing a limb? Or, growing an extra one just for funsies. That's the world comic books present to us when we think of human-animal hybrids. And we're still pretty far off from that sort of stuff, but we're closer than you might think.
You're talking about some Island of Dr. Moreau type stuff, Ben?
More like some Sabretooth stuff, you know what I'm saying?
Ideally, it would be Sabretooth, but you got to go through Moreau to get to Sabretooth.
That's right. Yeah, you got to break a few eggs to make a cheetah omelet. Yeah.
Did you ever read the actual book?
No, but I saw the incredible film and the documentary about the
Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer.
They were all totally insane.
Well, in the
his voice is so creepy.
There's so many stories about Marlon Brando. Without getting too far into them, the thing that's interesting about the book is that when the book was written, the doctor, the namesake of the film and the namesake of the story, he is using purely surgical methods. So he's not using any genetic methods to increase the cognitive abilities of these animals, these hybrids, these chimeras. He's instead just cutting them up so they walk like men.
Yeah, sort of like that movie Tusk. Did you see that horrible monstrosity? It's a Kevin Smith movie where he turns a podcaster into a walrus.
Yeah,
it's really awful.
Does.
It's really
just doesn't
bad.
Make any sense to me. Like the motivation of the guy, the fact that, spoiler alert, 3, 2, 1, the fact that the protagonist in Tusk, or the main character, also loses his mind, but nothing's really done to his mind other than, intense psychological torture. Like he's not lobotomized or anything.
I don't know, man. I'd lose my mind if I was turned into a walrus, I think.
I think I would have the presence of mind to ask for some people to help me with surgery to at least get me closer to my original form.
Instead of just being in a wildlife park?
Well,
spoiler, 3, 2, 1, spoiler.
It's fine. Sometimes I feel – sometimes directors or screenwriters get carried away with one image and it's just they'll spend hours trying to rationalize that image. That's for a different show. That's for a different show, I'm sure. But like that, like Moreau on the way to Sabretooth. We're already – this is the biggest spoiler. We as a species are already quite capable of making several types of human-animal hybrids, but in many cases it might be more accurate to call it an animal-human hybrid. In 2017, just last year, scientists announced that they created the first successful ones, and they weren't entirely accurate in that claim. Their project proved that human cells can be introduced to a non-human organism and they can grow within that organism. But what they didn't say is they were doing legitimate ethical science. In decades before this experiment in 2017, people have been doing plenty of legitimate unethical science. There are all these rumors we covered in earlier shows about a so-called Human Z, which is, genetically speaking, completely possible. It's close enough. You know what I mean? It would be probably very hard to bring it to term, and the creature would live a very cursed, unhappy life probably. But it's technically possible, just not ethically advisable. And in China, there's this I guess you would call it a story by two researchers, because there's not a lot of proof to back it up, that right before the Cultural Revolution, there was a successful experiment with a human-chimpanzee hybrid, and they had a female chimpanzee carrying essentially a human fetus. It was about 3 months pregnant, but then all the research was destroyed along with the individual. So, and then that's not even going into the Russian experiments, which are have much better documentation. Mm-hmm. And then in 2003, the first successful human-animal hybrid was made in a lab in Shanghai. Some scientists fused human cells in rabbit eggs, and they created the embryos of new creature that would be half rabbit, half human, never born again. These things officially have never been born.
And you know, the whole point of that study, at least, back in the day, according to the San Francisco Gate, was to create essentially a place where you could grow human stem cells.
Yes, yeah.
Within the rabbit creature that they're creating, half human, half rabbit thing.
And that's why when they destroyed the embryos, they harvested the stem cells, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So in the present day, we started really, really going into this with pigs. We've made pigs that are technically chimeras, organisms that are part human, part animals. The scientists at the Salk Institute found that they could inject a certain type of human cell, things called pluripotent cells, stem cells with unlimited changeable potential. They could implant these cells, and if they allowed the cells to develop to a specific degree, these cells could survive in pig embryos. They had to find sort of a Goldilocks zone to put this alien organic material in. And they went on to create 186 embryos, chimeric embryos that survived. Each only had about 1 in 100,000 human cells as their ratio. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're capable of making sheep that are about 0.01% human cells. The ultimate goal here is not to make a race of pig people or sheep folk. It's to use these animals as a harvesting ground for organs, which means within our lifetimes, if any of us needs to get a heart transplant, we may well end up with the heart of a pig.
Which is currently what happens now. If you get a valve replacement, it can be bovine, it can be porcine, it can be from some other animal. A lot of times it's a bovine valve.
Wow.
So we're already doing that, but it's not a human hybrid version of it or a full-on human one that was grown inside of a cow, say. Wow. I don't know. It's really interesting stuff.
I mean, it's interesting, though. Ethically, that would be less egregious to a lot of people than using a human heart, right?
Sure. Well, yeah. I guess it depends. It depends.
But then growing an animal and dedicating its entire life to having its organs harvested, a lot of people would have problems with that. They would also maybe talk about those problems while they were eating a hamburger.
Yeah. Agreed. It is an interesting thing. It feels like maybe they're going about it the wrong way, but I see the leap here. Who am I to say, by the way? Old boy Matt over here trying to tell science what to do. But it does feel like we're getting closer to a point where we'll be able to grow an organ, almost like 3D print an organ out of genetic material rather than having to grow one physically in a creature.
Yeah, we are getting closer. The problem is making the moving parts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It just feels in a way just that it's still even happening in 2017. I'm fascinated.
I know. It feels like a sort of sorcery, doesn't it? to mold living material in that manner. And also, this could make an episode all its own, because this doesn't even touch on what the nature of humanity is. Like, is it a simple ratio of cells? Is it once more than half of the cells in the animal's body by weight or whatever? Once they reach over 51%, does that animal become human?
It's a good question,
right? Or is it just the type of cells? If all of its cells are human, but it has the brain and the nervous system of a different animal, is it not human? You know what I mean? Where's the line? Is it at the brain? Is it at the ratio? What makes a living thing human, or what makes it sentient, right? Like, this is a question that we will eventually, as a species, have to answer.
It's like, do animals have souls?
Right, right. Or do they have legal rights?
What even is a soul?
Mm-hmm.
What even are legal rights?
How do we define this stuff, you know?
Conspiracy@howstuffworks.com. Send in your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are any shaman or lawyers out there, let us know what you think.
Or both. If you're a shaman lawyer, I would love to hear your what would that be? Litigious divinations.
That's genius, Ben.
We could do that, right? We also aren't mentioning, you know, Matt, we're not mentioning how scientists have grown an ear on the body of a mouse.
Yeah, that's something we can do.
As an ear replacement.
Oh.
No, it's true. It's true. You've done it. Would you do that? Would you, if you were missing an ear, would you take an ear grown from a rodent?
It's irreplaceable.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was feeling. Thank you, Noel.
we come up with these live, folks. Let us know. We're working live for you. But these are so far just pretty much organic things, right? I propose that we pause for a break from our sponsor, and we come back and we talk about technology. All right, so we are back. The four of us are definitely not extraordinary time travelers, but what we could be is biohackers. What the hell are biohackers, you may be asking us?
Well, yeah, it's people who already have an Apple Watch that monitors, you know, their heart rate, how much they sleep, exactly what they're eating, what their bowel movements look like and everything. But they just want to know more about what their body's doing. They want to have a little bit more more apps that they can use in the real world, more applicable things.
It's what you call wetware, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, except instead of just wearing it on your wrist, why not put it in your wrist or in your head?
Yeah, your brain.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We have the means. Like in the old beginning of the $6 Million Man television show, which I've never seen. I've just seen the YouTube clip of the intro. I thought that was cool. We have the means to build ourselves faster and stronger. And wetware, yes, is implanted within your body. So technically, like a pacemaker would be wetware. This stuff is already much more familiar to us and much more common than we think. The folks we call biohackers today are making these implants themselves, and often, in many cases, implanting them in themselves without medical supervision all the time, which drives some people just bananas. And they, you know, you can give yourself certain abilities.
Yeah.
We'll probably do an episode on this too, but like
crazy abilities.
Okay. Okay. The ones that we found and listed are maybe not super amazing, but they're getting there. And right now they're there to prove a point. Like their ability, you can install things to monitor your temperature, pretty much an Apple Watch.
Yes. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. You're right. It's inside. The ability to sense magnetic north, though, is that one is actually a patch.
Yeah, to sense magnetic north. That's cool.
Well, all it does is they recommend that you put the patch high on your chest,
yeah,
and then you get like a buzzy itch thing when you're facing magnetic north.
Isn't that nice? Just every time you look north.
Mm-hmm. And who doesn't want yet another unscratchable itch?
Yeah. I mean, that could be amazing if you're lost in the woods.
True. That's a really good point. As long as – yeah, no, no, no.
That's really
good. It's good. It's really good.
We're a desert. All right, whatever.
Yeah. Then the idea of implanting all kinds of stuff in your fingertips, right? Mm-hmm. I think we – did we talk about this on another – who was – Noel, I think maybe you and I were talking about this stuff, right? The one where you can sense magnetic fields if you're close to them.
Oh, you mean like the – with the radio quiet zone and stuff? Like people that have sensitivity to electromagnetic fields?
Oh, yeah. They could do that. I wonder if they would be the type to have that implant, though.
No.
Well, they would probably want something to shield them from said transmissions.
Yeah. Maybe detecting them would help them do that. But some biohackers have put small sensors in their fingertips or even put magnets in their fingertips, which seems neat but really inconvenient on a day-to-day basis.
Just if there's an on-off switch somewhere in your neck maybe or in your upper arm, then cool.
Yeah, that's the other question, right? Yeah, I mean, currently these implants are capable or they're more like proof of concept things.
Yeah.
No one's Magneto yet is what we're saying.
Well, at least Magneto hasn't shown up in the middle of New York City or Gotham or wherever else Magneto can show up. Please don't show up in Gotham, Magneto. That would be really cross-world and weird. Actually, it might help the DC universe.
So maybe it will. But actually, it would help them out a lot, at least in the film adaptations. But this is just the beginning of something, you know, and that's the argument they're making. They're paving the way. They see themselves as pioneers who are the vanguard for something that may become much more common and much more powerful in the future.
Yeah, because it does feel like at some point, and you listening out there, what do you think about this? But it does feel like we're getting closer and closer within the next few hundred years of becoming a lot more of a synthetic species.
Yeah, transhumanism, right?
Yeah, and I don't think that necessarily means biohacking in the way that it's being pursued right now. I think it's going to mean something completely different, much more synthetic than a synthetic addition to a biological entity.
I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, something human plus, right?
Yeah.
Or as Noah Yuval Harari calls it, homo deus.
Ooh.
Homo deus, homo deus. Anyway. So speaking of something completely different, this is one we put in just because I don't know. It's an ability. Is it extraordinary? We're talking about globe luxation. Two words, globe, space, luxation, L-U-X-A-T-I-O-N. What is this exactly?
Well, first of all, you should go ahead and search it on YouTube. That's probably the best way to do this.
It is safe for work.
It's fine. Yeah, you'll be okay. It's the thing where you've got eyes and then you could do this other thing where the eyes kind of go pop out a little bit or push out.
You mean just like bug out or literally pop out and hang by the optic nerve?
No, you don't pop them out, but they just kind of
– They bug
partially,
out.
Partially.
They bug.
Go out.
They're bugging.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're bugging out.
That's it.
There's a Guinness Book of World Records measurement for this, for the degree to which people can luxate, perhaps would be the word, to make their eyes pop out of their skulls.
Ooh, maximum luxation.
I think that could be a t-shirt. But that's the question, you know, is it useful? It doesn't seem particularly useful. It's interesting, but it's not like
– it could psych out your enemy.
Sure.
You know, if you were like in a street fight or something. And that's what I just thought of when you said that,
yeah.
Matt. It's like – you have achieved maximum luxation. And that's like, you know, your opponent. And then it causes the guy you're fighting against to freak out. And then you punch him in the nuts.
Yeah, or like the Maori practice of haka, you know, the ritualized dance, the war dance.
If you could haka and luxate, now you're on to something.
Haka luxation.
Ooh.
So while we're talking about eyes, this is one we found that's very interesting. We have a couple more with eyes. I guess we would call it super record reading. It's a very, very, very specific type of super sight. You see, there's a medical diagnostician in Philadelphia named Dr. Arthur Lentgen. And Dr. L over here can do something very weird. He can identify the music on a phonograph record, like on a vinyl record, just by looking at the grooves on its surface. He doesn't have to listen to it. he can look at it and he, it's like he can hear the music.
Wow. He doesn't even have to feel it or anything, because it's just such a tactile medium, the grooves and everything. I thought in my head when we were looking into this, I would imagine him feeling the grooves.
Kind of like
somehow,
a braille.
Yeah, and almost knowing that way. But just by sight, that's impressive.
Well, the claim was tested and verified by James Randi.
Wow.
Who depending on what side you of the fence you fall on our show, you either love or hate.
Yeah.
Or in my case, pity. But no, he's done important things. I just feel bad for him. But Dr. Lentgen has a couple of caveats for this. He says he can only identify post-Beethoven classical music if it's fully orchestrated. He cannot identify spoken word recordings or the works of contemporary classical composers who are relatively unknown. It's kind of like he has to already be somewhat familiar with the song.
I don't know about this, because I mean – yeah, I always have been fascinated by, you know, cutting records and like what that entails, and the fact that it is somehow physically making that sound. Because you can like have the record player, the electronics turned off, and you can turn the record, rotate it under the needle, and you'll still actually hear a faint, you know, recreation of the sound. I would want to know a little bit more about that, but I don't know, like. It's sort of like looking at a waveform of audio, right? So you could maybe identify the peaks and valleys of what a waveform looked like and be able to correlate it to a particular piece of music if you knew it super well.
Yeah.
You could say, here's those stabs of dun-dun-dun-dun, because those are the peaks, and then it gets quiet, and you could identify that. But I don't know that the grooves on a record quite correlate in that same way. Listeners, let me know if I'm wrong, but I don't know. Maybe it's just a matter of familiarizing yourself with it and just learning the language of what the grooves look like. But
I think that's what it has to be, because there's a great article on him in the LA Times from 1987 about the test that Randi gives him, and they have various records. Let me see. They had some controls, like they had two different recordings of Stravinsky's La Sacre du Printemps, and an Alice Cooper recording, and a spoken word recording, and then they had other stuff that fit into what he should be able to read, like The Planets by Holst, 1812 Overture by Tchaikovsky, Mozart symphonies, and a couple of other things. And here's the way he does this. He's a very, very nearsighted guy, super thick glasses, so they shuffle the recordings. He takes one off the pile. He takes his glasses off. He places his eye at the edge of the recording and slowly rotates it. As he's watching it, he's slowly rotating it.
And so he's looking at it like straight on, like across?
They're not – I haven't seen video of it.
Yeah. Interesting.
But they just said the edge of it. And then he said – when he made his guess, he said – I think that this is Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. However, there's an extra movement in here that I can't understand. Is it a strange recording? And Randi says, you know, I can't tell you. We got this whole test thing going on.
Yeah.
So the guy keeps reading this record. And then he says, yes, it is the Sixth Symphony, but it also contains an additional overture that I will guess is the Prometheus Overture. He was correct.
Wow.
Just from looking at this stuff. And then he –
dude, he figured out that one thing he was looking at, he was like, oh, man, this thing is
– German.
Or he's like, this thing is really weird. It's like disorganized. It's like gibberish. I don't understand what's happening in this record.
Yeah.
What is this thing? And it turned out to be an Alice Cooper record.
Yes. That was he didn't say that's totally Alice Cooper, but he did say it was gibberish.
Yeah.
And then he was also able to differentiate between like the nationalities of orchestras – which is just insane. I'm tempted to think, I don't know, maybe he just spent so much time, like as we said earlier, maybe he spent so much time listening to records and memorizing their movements and stuff.
But it does mean he's looking at records a whole lot.
A ton, at the very least. Yeah.
It's a very interesting way to pass the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and also he's a doctor.
Do you think he listens to them too? Do you think he enjoys music, or is he just sort of like this highly neurotic record viewer?
I don't know. I think he has to listen to them, because then because then his mind is associating two senses to kind of confirm what's happening. So he's watching the thing, and in his head he's hearing the song.
But see, my thing is this. Like, if I knew what record – if I knew intimately the look of a particular record, I could tell because there's thick lines between the songs.
Right.
And there's only – like, some records you can't fit – enough on one side that there's a lot of empty space in the center, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like a portion of the vinyl in the interior that's blank and just smooth. So I would argue that if you just memorized the look of a record, like in terms of how many tracks were on each side mm-hmm. and how much empty space there was and what it looked like, you could have like a signature in your head of, oh, this is what The Planets sure. looks like. This is what Houses of the Holy by Led Zeppelin looks like. You know, you could totally file that away in your mind without actually being able to interpret magically through sure. sight, you know, the sound, the look of the record.
But so. That's – I mean the only – that's where I think I'm at as well. The only – and that's what Randy concluded, by the way, something like that, but a little more the language he uses is a little different. But it's more or less the same thing. The big test then would be whether Dr. Lentgen could look at a record from a song he'd never heard and then sing along. That would be showing this ability. He would be a human record player.
That would be the next level of that this would be, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But there is another form of super sight that is a lot more useful. This is very interesting, but I don't think super record reading qualifies for Avenger level, but super sight just might.
Okay, so super sight. Now, we aren't necessarily talking like eagle vision or laser sight or cyclops stuff going on. In this version of our superheroes, we're talking about actual just super sight, amazingly good seeing. Veronica Seeder, Seider, of Stuttgart, Germany, she holds the record of having the absolute best eyesight in the world. So I have – I'm terribly nearsighted. I don't know about you guys if you have any of that stuff going on. But my visual acuity is nowhere near 20/20, which is considered average. Good. That's what human vision should be. But she has been measured around 22.
20/2.
Yeah. Yeah. Not 20/20, 22. This means she can identify people from more than a mile away.
Yeah.
She can identify tiny little people.
So would be a great sniper, right?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
And that's strange because surely there's a genetic component to that. But how do we find that gene? How do we isolate it? How do we express it? I was looking ardently too for someone with super speed.
Like a Flash?
Yeah, like a Flash. So not an Usain Bolt who is very fast over short distances, but someone who is very fast running at one type of speed. But I was looking for something that was just – super speed in general. Mm-hmm. And the closest I could find was what we could call super reflexes. There's a guy who holds a very, very specific record for this in the Guinness Book of World Records, which is admittedly not the most solid source, but his name is Asao Machi, and he is from Chiyoda, Tokyo, Japan. He is fast enough with his sword that he can cut BB pellets in half. And
there's a video you can watch of this. I remember seeing this on Reddit / videos.
And that to me, it seems to indicate that his reaction time is much, much quicker than the average bear or the average sword-wielding bear.
Absolutely.
So This seems neat. Now, this is a question for the audience. Is this something that is learned or is this something genetic? You know what I mean? Aside from the technique you have to learn to wield a sword.
Yeah, there are a lot of proper techniques that take a long time to learn that I think he probably had to have mastered to be able to do this.
But like, okay, here's the question. If you were playing whack-a-mole or something, would he be the world champion of that too? Would he just be like, bam, 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 bam?
Maybe.
Because he would react so quickly? I don't know. It's a good question.
We should put him in front of one of those machines, see what happens.
We should write to him. He set the record in 2013. He's probably still around.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? I bet he replies to emails very quickly. Oh, that was not worth it. But these are some of the powers we collected today. And yes, some of them may seem more useful than others, but it leads us to a big question that I don't think we quite answered in our first episode of this series. And that question is, why does this actually matter, right? So far, it sounds pretty inspiring or at least interesting. Through various means, certain parts of the human population, as you said, Matt, very small parts of the human population, have acquired fascinating and at times supremely useful abilities. And people will even argue that certain things that are genetic disadvantages are themselves extraordinary abilities. I'm partially colorblind, but if someone was like, Ben, what are you going to do with this amazing ability to not see all the colors? I would shrug because it seems relatively useless, right? But at this point, there's no threat of an ascendant superhuman class, right? A race of superior people.
Thank goodness?
Kind of. There's kind of not.
The billionaires?
But there is, yeah, that's the thing. There is a threat of this happening because as we speak, as we record today in 2018, three countries have been conducting extensive research on human enhancement projects that touch on almost every single ability we mentioned in this series with
except for super eyes.
Except for globe luxation.
Yeah.
Yes. And
maximum luxation.
Thank you. Yes. The Pentagon is not as concerned with that yet. But we know for a fact that not only are three countries doing this, but they have been doing it for years, for possibly decades. Well, definitely decades now, or it's 2018. Back in the 90s and late 80s, the U.S., particularly the Pentagon, began investing huge amounts of money in research and the creation of super soldiers, individuals enhanced through technology, drug use, and nowadays, in the future, the very near future, genetic alteration to make them impervious to pain with superhuman stamina, super strength, reflexes that put Isao Machi to shame, and even superhuman intellect and no need to sleep. But here's the frightening thing. The U.S. government claims that they started doing this because China and Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time, were already operating enhanced human programs for similar purposes, to build super soldiers. And the implied threat here is that other nations do this without following the same ethical constraints as the U.S. does, in theory, on paper. But, you know, whatever.
That is really freaky, especially when you think about some of the efforts that Germany was making back in the day to, you know, make the Übermensch and actually, I guess not genetic manipulation, but some breeding stuff that was going on, and there was some creepiness going on in Germany, and to think that it's spread out amongst all these other superpowers now.
Yeah, right, because the Soviet Union and China survived World War II, but Germany did not. Just a lot of its scientists.
Yeah.
And then even in the recent years, you know, news came and went about China's alleged eugenics program for basketball players, which has a surprising amount of sand to it. So that's the conclusion today. The scary thing is the superpowers themselves want superpowers, and they're not going to stop researching them. People, most likely soldiers and analysts with extraordinary abilities, are on the way, and the only debate now is who will get them and how these powers will be used. People are already arguing this violates the Geneva Conventions, but there's not really a compelling way to stop this.
Yeah, even to get it on the books anywhere, if it's happening beneath the black budget of, let's say, a Pentagon or some other, you know, more secretive budget.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do you think? Is it already this is just my opinion, but I feel like it's already gone too far, and the possible medical benefits are so attractive and have the potential to help so many people that they will always be used as a rationalization to build like these unsleeping, unfeeling murder machines.
I think it's not needed anymore for the same reason that I don't understand the biohacking wetware stuff. All of that kind of research has been switched over to artificial intelligence and drones and robotics, that because you don't need a human, you don't need to breed a human, you just build a thing.
Yeah, you don't think it's sort of an extension of like extreme body modification culture and kind of fads or whatever, like the idea of being the complete architect of your own physicality. You know?
Oh, no, no. I see that. I see that. I'm speaking specifically to superpowers, the national countries, the superpowers, trying to create superhuman soldiers.
Oh, sure. It seems like the time for that has passed.
Well, I mean, it's still there, and it's creepy that they're doing it. They're probably still doing it because why would you stop? Mm. It's just there's probably not as much money going into it as there is going into the AI cheap drones. Kind of thing.
Well, it also depends on the nature of the military. So one of the greatest resources that the military of China has is a massive population. Yes. So is it at what point is it more cost effective to modify those people versus manufacturing a drone? It's a weird way to think about it.
That's a good way to think about it.
It's brutal.
Not good. Because to some, and at some point in some societies, perhaps the cost of human life is cheaper than the cost of good tech.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the AI problem, which is right now most of what we think of as AI is not a machine consciousness. It's something that is able to solve certain problems very well or maybe find certain patterns, right, very quickly.
Think about it this way, though. To grow an effective combat-ready human being, it takes, what, 15 to 18 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point too.
So you could mass produce a drone, I mean, pretty easily and pretty cheaply at this point.
Yeah, yeah. We'd have to be privy to some numbers that would be pretty frightening to make the call on that. But I bring up the AI because would it be better to enhance – so AI doesn't have the capability – and in some cases, it's ethically constrained from making some decisions, right? It doesn't have the ability to make all the nuances of analysis that a human can at this point. So if we're warmongers, right, if we're war leaders, do we make an imperfect AI or do we bend the rules of ethics and hook someone up such that through implants they can communicate directly with a drone or with a machine? And then, hey, while we're in their brain, why don't we put in an implant that will be able to deliver systemized instructions to them or turn off emotional reactions, both of which are possible.
Or, you know, explode if they try to run away.
Both. You know what I mean? Make it a one-stop shop. Let's go for it. I could see that happening. And I could see people signing up too. Dolce et decorum est, and so on.
Don't listen to him. Well, what do you think? Let us know. There's a lot to chew on here. This has been a fun one. Ben, you're right. These were a little different than the ones in our part one episode, and I get the connection to the Great Lakes Avengers now because some of their powers are a little, shall we say, underwhelming. But wrapped up in some of these slightly useless and underwhelming powers are a lot of good thought experiments and interesting ideas, and the notion of what it means to be human I think is really at the forefront of these discussions. So I'm really into it, and I thought it was a fun one.
Yes, and while you're letting us know what you think, you're probably wondering which method of internet media you will use to express your thoughts. Yeah, you can find us at Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all the hits, all the good ones, but you can also talk to us live in person on the road because we are going on tour.
That's right. There are only a few weeks, maybe a week and a half left by the time you're hearing this episode. You have to get your tickets now. If you're going to be in Boston, in Arlington, that's DC basically, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, or Atlanta, we are coming to a place near you between October 23rd and October 28th. Go to stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com and then click on the live shows tab to get your tickets right now.
And just so you know, sometimes that live shows thing, it's hidden. You got to click on more. My browser, for some reason, always contracts those little menu items. So you don't see it right away. You got to click on more, and then live shows is the last thing that comes up. But those dates are beginning Tuesday, October 23rd at the Armory in Boston, Thursday, October 25th at the Arlington Cinema and Draft House in Arlington, Virginia, just outside D.C., Friday, October 26th. 26th at the World Cafe Live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Saturday, October 27th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, and then Sunday, October 28th at Terminal West here in Atlanta. So get your tickets there at stufftheydontwantyouknow.com and then find that live shows tab wherever it may be hiding.
And of course, you can also call us 1-833-STDWYTK. And if none of that particularly luxates your globes, feel free to write an email to us directly. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.